previous guest on the show, Chris Mooney, has a new article out in Mother Jones this month. The headline is unlike what you'd expect from Mooney, who's often yes. labeled an accommodationist. Mm-hmm. The headline is "Science and Religion Really Are Enemies After All."
Now, this is coming from a study. This is not. Yeah. This is not an opinion piece. This is.
Yeah, this
we've
is
got
a
the facts
study.
To back it up now.
This is Princeton economist Roland Benabou.
Bonobo?
Bonobo?
No, it's not Bonobo.
Benabou?
Benabou.
Benabou.
I don't know. Something Frenchy.
Princeton economist Roland B. looked, they compared countries to other countries and some of the states within the United States. Mm-hmm. And came to the conclusion that higher levels of religiosity are actually related to lower levels of scientific innovation. Mm-hmm. And their kind of measure for innovation, because that's a very difficult thing to quantify, their measure for innovation was patents. How many patents are registered in these different states? Pretty consistent finding. They controlled for all sorts of variables, you know, income per capita, mm-hmm. the rates of higher education, you know, the population of the state.
Which often ties into religion as well. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of connecting factors. Yeah,
so all those statistical controls sort of eliminates other possible, like, well, it could be the economy of the region, or it could be the education level, to more closely target. Like, I guess their point is that one way to interpret that would be that the religiosity has sort of a specific effect in inhibiting people's coming up with ideas and filing their patents.
Yeah, and it's important to say they're not saying this is the key driver of scientific innovation. It's that once you remove all the other well-known sources of innovation, there is this kind of residual amount of extra innovation in these less religious states that seems to be explained by religion.
It's one of those things that seems kind of obvious if you look back at history and you consider different cultures and their scientific advancements as related to their religion. Like Egypt had a very orderly view of the world, and so they come up with some pretty fantastic scientific advancements, including a relatively accurate calendar and a lot of engineering things, you know, all of which would kind of fall under the patent banner if we're using the same thing here. Whereas you turn to, you know, Mesopotamia, and you have a much less scientific view of the world, an ordered view of the world. Things are much more complex, and you get still some great advancements, but very different types. So religion often affects the kinds of advancements or lack thereof, and will push cultures to a certain stopping point a lot of times. Like, they can't really go much further into biology or astronomy or whatever because they have these religious beliefs that says, look, the Earth is the center of the universe or what have you, and that puts a stopping block on further advancement.
So you always hear this argument, though, when I've engaged people, is that they say it's contradicted by history that a lot of the great scientists and philosophers were Christians or religious people themselves, and the Isaac Newtons of the world and all these things get out. And one thing that always struck me that is a problem with that argument is it depends on what the scientific issue is in question.
Exactly.
I don't know that many religious people except super like fundamental, like the Amish or we just talked about, where they object to science or engineering in general.
Right.
They're just
past 18, whatever their cutoff.
Yeah. If you're a fundamentalist, you in fact love the products of a modern society like YouTube, where you can post your beheadings or, you know, weapons and things like that, bomb materials. It's when the scientific inquiry process gets into more areas that would be a turf battle with the religious domain.
Right.
So obviously things like the origin of the universe or evolution of the species or human consciousness, those things are different than building widgets.
Or you know, Isaac Newton as an example, physics, especially his idea of physics, fit very well
into his – ordered universe, an orderly God created an orderly laws of the universe.
Yeah.
And so I wouldn't expect that religious people or churches or doctrine would have any problem with that sort of scientific inquiry. But then you get like a Galileo sort of thing where, but wait, the orbits aren't perfect or that it doesn't fit with this notion of, you know, there's pockmarks on these other heavenly bodies. Then you start to get things like, well, that can't be.
The universe is clearly older older than 5,000-6,000 years.
Yeah.
So
I don't think that there's an inherent – any type of scientific or technical finding is contrary to any type of religion. It's when it question, it's when it challenges the religious authority to decide, you know, things like that.
But then this study is interesting because they're looking at patents, which is, you know, it's certainly one way to measure scientific advancement. And that's largely engineering. We're talking about inventing things, which is not
– That's not really science.
Is that your approach
to really
this?
Science. Engineering is not really science in the sense of targeted things to specific problems. You know, I always psychologicalize things, but the guys that I knew in college that were the engineers were often the most rigid conservative religious types because they built a wall between that. There's even an article that came out a while back called Engineers and Suicide Bombers, like question mark, because the guys who did the World Trade Center were highly technically trained engineers. Yeah. The science is in service of solving a specific practical problem.
Right.
Engineers aren't interested in the – like what it all means big picture wise.
This study would suggest that that may not be true.
I think that's maybe the real interesting thing in this study is that there is such a strong relationship between the religiosity of the population and their patents. It's so consistent too. If we're going to link to the study, but if you look at it, this is – across regions, across countries, across the world. It's this relationship just seems to hold up no matter what they try to tease out of it.
It's related, but I think that the relationship there is that that there might be an inhibitory effect with religion with certain types of like curiosity about the world that could manifest itself in patents.
Yeah, certainly.
But I think that what I'm saying is the relationship is stronger when you talk about science that directly challenges the underpinnings of the whole story.
Certainly. But yeah, I do find that interesting that it could just filter down to this general effect of stamping out curiosity or whatever. The study's authors admit this is all correlation. This is nobody knows exactly what's causing it. He thinks it really comes down to the lead author said the political power of the religious population in a given area. Technical progress or social change tend to be met with greater resistance and diffuse more slowly, he said, in these particular areas. In areas that are more secular, quote, discoveries and innovations occur faster, and some of this new knowledge inevitably erodes beliefs in any fixed dogma. So he was speculating that causally the relationship probably works both ways to some degree. Religion might dampen down scientific innovation or scientific curiosity. But at the same time, innovation as it's going on, if you're in that area, it can affect religion. It can erode people's more traditional beliefs.
Well, the vision that popped in my mind is somebody getting a patent for a new Bible reading device on your iPhone that gives verses. That would be something where you would be religious and have it file a patent. It would be a great thing. But then it starts generating things that don't match with translations. Well, this one says that and the other one says that. What are we? It's a satanic invention. You should have never gotten that patent.
Now, there's just looking at this chart that the article offers, there's something that it should have been completely obvious. But China and Japan have both the lowest levels of the group studied – of the country studied, of religiosity, and the highest levels of innovation.
Yeah.
China and Japan, duh. I mean, everything's coming out of China and Japan.
They were pretty high up there.
And then you have Iceland, which is also hugely innovative and
– I was surprised. They were a bit of an outlier. They were more heavy religiously than the rest. And that was one of the things that struck me as looking at the different charts of the study is that you definitely see all the data points clustering together. Mm-hmm. But there are tons of outliers also.
Yes. Yeah.
It's a cloudy – it's a messy cloud.
Portugal. Man, innovation in Portugal was just at a – minimum.
There's a lot of variables behind innovation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the religiousness or the secularity of your area, I guess, is just one.
Well, as with the other studies that we've talked about, when you can move from a correlational to an experimental method, that's usually preferred. Mm-hmm. How do you experimentally assign things like, you know, patents and whatnot? You can't really do that. But there are some other studies that have addressed this issue of whether religion is at odds with scientific interpretations of things. And like I was saying before, one of the things that cuts a little deeper than just engineering or innovation in a technical sense is explanations for your psychological experience, mm-hmm. i.e. things that conflict between the brain versus your mind or soul. And so there was a study that came out last year called The Neuroscience and the Soul: Competing Explanations for the Human Experience. The lead author is Jesse Lee Preston. But what they were getting at here is there a hydraulic or a incompatible relationship when one goes up, the other must go down, between mm-hmm. religious belief and specifically giving people the notion that neuroscience, so things like magnetic resonance scanning, brain scans and things like that, could provide explanations for things that are a little bit deeper, like your love or your emotions mm-hmm, or mm-hmm. your soul or things
we're talking
like
about a field of science that's going to conflict a lot with religious beliefs.
Yeah, because
theoretically.
You see every day now there's like a new study where they show these bright and shiny brain photographs of your mm-hmm. brain in action that say, you know, when you fall in love, this part of the brain lights up. Or, right. you know, or even like the stuff that I see when you have a religious experience,
yes.
this part of your brain lights
up. Glossolalia
or
anything
in tongues.
Like that. Yeah.
You wonder if somebody has a dualist view of the of themselves, like, yes, obviously there's the brain, but these special domains like religion and my thoughts and emotions, those can only be accounted for by my mind and soul.
Right. Mm-hmm.
What would they make of when they are exposed to explanations like, oh, neuroscience, that stuff's covered with that too.
What do they think when they see the God helmet?
The God helmet, yeah, where people are like, Jesus was talking to me when you flip the switch.
Yeah.
So the in this study, what they did is they did a couple subcomponents, but they were all based on giving people exposure to conditions where, again, neuroscience could explain stuff like that, like your emotions. So the first study, for example, was they gave people sample course descriptions for college courses. And in some of the conditions, the neuroscientific explanation was complete, like, oh, mechanisms of falling in love through your brain or something like that, as opposed to there's gaps in knowledge, like science can't explain some stuff. And what they did was for their dependent measure was whether the people valued their soul or not. That is, they gave people scenarios where what if you could be frozen and then thawed out later on? The only problem is that your soul would be destroyed in the process. Would you be willing to undergo, you know, cryogenics and things like that? And so what they found was is that people were a little bit more carefree with their concept of the soul when they were given hard neuroscientific explanations for things. So, like, in other words, when the brain can explain these deep emotional things, people would one of the clever things I thought in one of the studies was they gave them a little card that said your soul on it. It had a unique stamped number there. And then the experimenter tried to bargain with them, like, would you be willing to sell me your soul card for how much, you know, for $10? And so they actually put a price on the person's. Previous research, by the way, has found that even people who are skeptics or atheists or not religious people, they are reluctant to sell their soul to the experimenter when offered.
I would sell my soul for enough money to buy those little sponge dinosaurs that grow when you spray them with a hose. Simpsons, anyone? Bart sells his soul to Milhouse. The Simpsons Marathon was on recently, and I saw that episode.
That's right, because
one of the greatest.
Milhouse is like, well, why don't you sell it to me then? Bart's like, sure, chum.
For $5, and he buys the little.
That was one of the. Yeah, that is a good episode, because then he has these nightmares where he doesn't have his soul doppelganger.
Yes.
But yeah, so even people like that are sort of laugh it off. There are studies that show that they hesitate a little bit when the experimenter challenges them to sell their soul.
Mm-hmm.
But what they found in the Preston study here was that exposure to evidence that neuroscience can explain everything without gaps made people more willing to kind of do away with their soul or sell it for cheap or things like that compared to people that were exposed to conditions where, well, science can't explain everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so what the authors – the way that they put it was – is that there was, again, like a hydraulic relationship, a teeter-totter, if you will, that the belief in your soul decreases when you think that neuroscience provides a strong mechanistic explanation for the mind. But if there's gaps in the explanation, you know, yes, science does some things but not everything, that enhances the person's belief in a soul or their valuing of a soul.
So in order to eliminate belief in the soul, all we'd have to do is educate people better about neuroscience.
Well, here's the problem though. People are, as we've talked about in the show, you can educate people about a lot of things, but if those things have deep emotional, maybe even unconscious roots, sometimes it can backfire.
What if you explain their emotions to them using neuroscience? Would that work?
Then they just curl in the corner and go into a fetal position. I've tried that.
What if we control their emotions with neuroscience?
Take the red pill class. This half of the class, red pill. Other half, blue pill.
It makes sense. And I wonder if we're almost seeing a parallel of this developing in theology. One of the things of the past decade that I've seen change a lot in talk in Christian circles is this greater embrace of Christian materialism. We even have some people at Calvin College, some of the head theologians there, who still talk about a soul, but when you press them about it, they believe that the soul is some aspect of the brain. And they base this on the idea that the Jewish tradition, that there will be a physical resurrection of people's bodies, not a necessarily some sort of spiritual resurrection or a rapture.
The brain itself.
And what's interesting is they often back themselves up. They back up their position by evoking the philosophy of mind arguments against dualism, by evoking the evidence from neuroscience. I mean, there are other people like the Creation Research Institute. William Dembski, for example, has been writing some pretty aggressive papers trying to target materialist assumptions in neuroscience and how wrong that is. That's what we talked about in our episode with Stephen Novella. So there are definitely people who are holding the line on the soul, but I wonder if others are just saying, you know what, let's not make this another conflict for religion. Let's preempt them and adopt this different metaphysics.
The magisteria are moving inward, to put it into the overlapping magisteria things, and that is the conflicts are becoming less and less about age of the earth things, although there are some holdouts, obviously.
Well, of course.
But it's becoming more as the brain science develops, the borderline, the no man's land is becoming more and more internal. And you can see why, because that does pose problems for, you know, that we think of it that way. But even the most, you know, not particularly contemplative college student must be sitting there looking at this stuff like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
If the brain is – if my thoughts are a product of a mechanistic thing like the brain and, you know, genes and chemicals and stuff can alter the thoughts, that alters things like morals, beliefs, subjective experiences. Those things are just merely electrified meat.
Yeah, and it's remarkable that the internal is becoming like the last refuge of non-strict fundamentalist religious people, where they say, well, you know, my mind, my soul, that's where I know that God exists, because neuroscience is pretty good. We can explain a lot of this stuff that – there's not a lot of places for them to hide the God in the gaps when it comes to neuroscience. But yeah,
and we should say not all religions. I mean, like Buddhists, for example.
There are gaps. But
yeah. Well, yeah, and there always will be.
But yes. But yeah, those gaps are closing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was another study that was interesting that I read recently that was utilizing terror management theory, which some of our listeners might have heard us go on about in previous episodes, that – but in this case, what they looked at was the person's mortality salience or contemplation of their own death as it affected their sense of connectedness with the rest of nature, like their naturalness. Mm-hmm. I think we might have mentioned before things like if you challenge people with thoughts about their own demise or their death, they become less willing to view themselves as being, you know, essentially an animal. Or they might defend themselves against their own mortality by saying that they're, you know, a dualistic thing. I'm not just an animal. So things like they become less, they become more objectifying of animals and pets and things like that under threats of death. But not everybody, as you might imagine, people that are the more sort of digging in tight are religious fundamentalists, because their worldview is much more dualistic and literalistic.
Yes.
That is, there's a literal immortality.
There's a lot more to threaten there.
You don't just move into the light. You actually bodily go there with Jesus as you and Jesus as a person. And so in this particular study, the title is Faith and Nature, the Effect of Death-Relevant Cognitions on the Relationship Between Fundamentalism and the Connectedness to Nature. The lead author is named Matthew Vess. But they took people who were high religious fundamentalists and they exposed them to things like thoughts of their own mortality, like write about your death or things like that. And then the other side, they looked at how connected they felt with nature. So things like, do they feel part of the natural world as opposed to separate from that? You know, that you are just as physical as that tree or that animal there, as opposed to, no, I'm special, I'm different. And as you might imagine from the context we're talking with, the fundamentalists, if they're a high fundamentalist and threatened with thinking about death, they became more disconnected from nature. Hmm. That is, they felt that the natural world was more separate from themselves when they're scared about dying. Now, that seems of mild interest, but if you think about that, what effect would that sort of defensiveness have on things like climate change or, you know, end of the world type stuff? It also explains why these things are not just factual issues. If you come right. at people and say, look, the planet's warming, we're all going to wipe ourselves out.
Yeah.
If you are dug in
– My real treasure's in heaven, Luke.
Yes. See, that's a problem because those people, if you freak them out with threats like death, fear, whatever, they sometimes dig themselves even tighter to, no, God would never let that happen. Or, yeah who cares about the natural world? Mm-hmm. We're building up treasures in heaven, some sort of nonsense like that. That is, it has implications for sometimes it could backfire to do the scare the hell out of them approach to things like, you're going to ruin the planet. Or, you know, we're going to wipe people out with nuclear weapons.
Go the stewardship route.
Route. Try to frame it in terms of the religious values of why they should take care of the planet or why it's important that the planet is warming, not that we're all going to die because if they're sort of
– Act now or we're all screwed. Yeah,
say things like God made – you believe that God made this world and that it's a a special place. You have enough responsibility to take care of it instead of you're going to die if you don't do this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is God's world.
And even just for non-psychological reasons, there are organized networks of groups that are promoting environmentalism from a religious perspective. It's easier to tap in somebody into that.
And then there's that the recent craze of people making their cars pollute as much as possible.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Have you seen this?
No.
Oh, it's horrible.
Is that a parody?
It's disgusting.
No, this is a real thing. People will –
They're like the drill, baby drill
They
type?
Do something – I'm going to sound like an idiot explaining
it. I don't know anything about cars.
They do something to build up the level of coal or carbon in their exhaust pipes, and then they eject it all out at once.
So they're posting videos of their
– Big black clouds of soot.
Viewing.
Yeah. I think on Colbert they had these – assholes drive up to some woman and like act like they were trying to pick her up, and then they drove past and blew the soot in her face. But apparently, this is, if you're a conservative anti-environmentalist nowadays, this is like the fun hobby on the weekends.
Well, we should mention too that study they just talked about, theory management, they even controlled for political conservatism.
Yeah.
My first thought was, well, obviously fundamentalists are going to be disconnected from nature because they're also conservative. And it wasn't just due to that. There was a specific religion. There's an obvious political component. And now it's almost to be a conservative means certain environmental positions, global warming. But this one is that religion seemed to add a little bit extra on to that above the political conservative uniquely. That is – it's a defense against mortality to feel that you are just part of decaying nature and the rest of the planet. I mean, and that goes by, we've talked about mythology that goes all the Christianity and Judaism are very dualistic. Nature versus body and spirit are two different things, sort of dualism that's not present in all the religions, in the Eastern ones, for example. That if you have a mythology that the garden – the garden goes back – if you believe in all that stuff literally, that to be natural is to be sinful, or anything that's spontaneous is done in direct contradiction to what God told you to do, that's going to set up a whole variety of attitudes about the world as being – like pilgrims used to view the natural world as being something to be fixed or it's evil and
although
broken.
Weirdly, if you actually read Genesis 2 with Adam and Eve before the fall of man – they're vegetarians. They're not killing animals even for clothing.
Even the lions were vegetarians.
Exactly. There's a responsibility to the environment there, which a lot of Christians do acknowledge, and it causes them to care about the environment.
There are plenty of green verses and like pro animal verses too. Yeah. Still practices that many of us would find barbaric.
Right.
Yeah, regulations and the laws about treating animals well and everything. Unfortunately, the Apostle Paul ruined all of that by commenting on it and saying, do you think that was for animals or nature? No, that was God telling you should pay your ministers. But anyways.
Good old Paul.